From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a photograph. Earlier this month, journalist Nicholas Kristof wrote a piece for the New York Times titled, "This is What Our Yemen Policy Looks Like." The piece opened with a large photo of a 12-year-old girl named Abrar, who is starving. It's a difficult image to view. It should be. Abrar weighs 28 pounds. Her ribs and shoulder blades are well-defined under her skin. Kristof reports that doctors don't know if she will survive, and she is one of 12 million Yemenis on the brink of famine or suffering from it now as a result of the Saudi Arabian war in Yemen. Already 85,000 children may have died. Kristof calls Americans complicit in the crisis as the country supports the war. In his column, he wrote, quote, "The parents of starving children allowed photographs to be taken because they hope that people outside their own country will act differently if they understand the human cost of 3 years of war," end quote. And Kristof posted the photo to Facebook, but the social media platform, at least for hours, was deleting it, citing it as inappropriate content. Kristof fired back, saying that as a media gatekeeper, Facebook was preventing the world from seeing how dire and tragic the situation has become. Well, 24 hours later, Facebook relented and called the deletion a mistake. The move has kicked off a fresh debate about what social media policies and how platforms decide what we as users are and are not allowed to see. What kind of problems are created if we censor photographs of this nature? And what are Facebook's actual policies here? This comes at a time where Facebook is facing a lot of criticism for other stuff, too. So our guests are going to help us work through various questions related to these subjects this hour. Joining us in studio, William Snyder is a four-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and chairs the photojournalism program at RIT. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Jen Poggi is an assistant professor of photojournalism at RIT and former photo editor for the Associated Press and for U.S. News and World Report. Jen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And also with us is Scott Maloof, an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. Scott, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Just understanding Facebook like you have to, whether you want to or not, Scott Maloof, I just want to start with you and understand something first and foremost here. Facebook can delete whatever they want to, yeah?
Yeah, the law generally allows them to have some editorial control over what's going on their platform.
Okay, so fair enough. So this was a question of whether they should do it, not whether they could do it.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to get to how they could in a second, but I want to talk about, you know, what this image has sort of meant to telling this story. And, you know, listeners, if you haven't seen it, I think you should. I asked my six-year-old son to take a look at it. I think we should all be viewing images like this. And this is another moment, William Snyder, where I think photography is vital to this story. What did you make of the kerfuffle at Facebook over this?
Well, let me just start by saying I'm one of these people that believes that we need to see more, not less, of these things. And I realize that many, many times this is difficult for people to see. But for me, that's part of the equation. It needs to be difficult. People need to be shocked by this. People need to understand what's going on in the world and what it really means. We're supporting the Saudi Arabians bombing Yemen. What does that mean? Well, this is what it means in personal, you know, human terms. It's not dollars. It's not bombs. It's not any of that stuff. It's personal cost. So I believe we need to see that. There are lots of people out there and even colleagues of mine that do not agree with that. So, you know, yes, this needs to be there. People need to see it and understand it.
Okay. Jen, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting issue to unpack because there's a lot of contributing factors. The base question of whether this is, you know, whether we need to see the picture, you know, unequivocally, yes. You know, and I think that the controversy that we're talking about today, you know, is a little bit more complicated, you know, to unpack, but I think it forces us to ask a question about, you know, Facebook and other social media platforms as a gatekeeper, because we know so many people do get their news and information through those platforms.
I'm going to turn to Scott in a second for a little understanding about if Facebook is going to choose to delete, or at least how they sort of scan and I don't even know how many photographs would be posted on Facebook on a daily basis. I mean, it's a huge, huge number.
Yeah.
So it's a big ask. So we'll talk about how they go about this in just a second. But Jen, you know, following up on the photograph itself here, is anything about that photograph obscene?
No.
I mean, I can't imagine why it
and
would be.
I also think it's important for context, because some of your listeners may not be aware that, you know, this is not the first time. This is the certainly we have lots of debate about pictures in our industry, whether to publish or not to publish images is pretty much a daily conversation that's going on in newsrooms. But the issue of Facebook and others deleting content has been happening, you know, fairly regularly over the last couple of years, and for a number of reasons, and we can get into that.
Listeners, I would like to hear from you if you have reached a tipping point with any social media, Facebook included. Yeah, I just saw this in the last hour from NBC News' Casey Hunt, who writes, "Dear friends, I'm deleting my Facebook account. I've been thinking about this for quite some time, as story after story has been written about how the people who own this platform use the information we voluntarily give them in our pursuit of maintaining friendships and connections." And she says, "Unfortunately, I simply don't trust them anymore. I won't be staying on the platform in 2019. And she says it's for a number of reasons, not just the story that we're talking about today. But I do wonder, with the heat that Facebook has taken for a lot of different things, if you're going to go in that direction. Is this the end for you, or are you frustrated at all with what you're experiencing as a user? 844-295-TALK. We'd love to hear from you. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Scott Maloof, I don't want to diminish the importance of a media gatekeeper like Facebook having the responsibility to police images and occasionally delete if there's truly obscenity, if there's child pornography, if there's something that is obviously crossing a line. I mean, that's they have to do that, right? We all agree on that, don't they?
Right. That's generally accepted. Like terrorist content, you know, child pornography, everyone agrees that should go.
And there will always be something subjective about where a line would be, right? I would think.
I think the easiest way I can demonstrate that the rules are very subjective is Facebook in April made their rules public, and they said this is how we moderate content. The rules expanded quite a bit from, say, 400 words per category to, you know, 800 or 1,200, just as a rough example. You know, once you really start to dig in, things get much, much longer.
Okay, and Jen?
I think they opened their guidelines in April in response to the FOSTA-SESTA ruling, or the bills that were signed into law, and that had worked their way through Congress and Senate, sort of mandating in terms of the online sex trafficking and, you know, and other issues. They were trying to pass these bills to address those issues and Backpage.com and others like that from knowingly publishing, you know, material around sex work, sex act, you know, and other kinds of issues. But there were long concerns around how broadly this law defined obscenity and issues relating to that. And there are a lot of people who've been cautionary about it overstepping into free speech and interpretation. So I think that there's, you know, again, that gets in the weeds a little bit, but I think it does play into whether there are sort of algorithms and techniques used by social media platforms to detect that may not be stringent enough or have a human eye to sort of then have a secondary look and say, wait a minute, no, this is a news image. This is a different level of value.
Let me unpack that, because there's a lot going on there. So if you think about where we started, you know, three decades ago, you know, you have the laws we have, say, on defamation, invasion of privacy. They're very human based. OK, so if Evan were to defame me, you know, it's in the community. It's easily understood how far that defamation might go. Once you have the internet come out, then all of those rules that are easily applied kind of start to go poof, and it becomes much more difficult because Evan defamed me on Facebook. Well, is that case in New York, or is that case in California? Is that in England, which is a really good defamation jurisdiction. So back in the 80s, we had the Communications Decency Act come up, tried to do a bunch of things, but the one thing that's remained is Section 230.
Right.
And what 230 does is 230 says, okay, we know that a lot of these traditional rules can be a problem for these online companies because relationships are now spread far and wide, and because things that would have taken a ton of time, Evan prints a leaflet, I respond with my angry response leaflet, you know, and those have to be distributed, now can happen instantaneously mm-hmm. for no cost. So 230 says, okay, you, if you're an internet service platform or a speaker, and these are really highly technical terms, generally we're not going to make the platform responsible for what the speakers do. So Evan posts that defamatory thing about me on Facebook. I can still sue Evan. I cannot sue Facebook. What FOSTA does is FOSTA walks back some of those protections. And the big concern comes in is now you're seeing this. A lot of online companies are saying, okay, our liability may be much broader than it used to be for things that are related to or could implicate sex trafficking. And so we're going to crack down on nudity, on content. You know, Facebook recently was criticized because, you know, they have some new rules about expressing, you know, what kind of partner you want, what your orientation is. And you're seeing, for example, Tumblr, which was well known to have a lot of content of a sexual nature, said, we're going to knock all of that out. And you could see why the companies are saying the risks are getting too high, our users are demanding something different, and so we are going to change this. And this, I think, this you know, takedown of this post is a good example. But the rules are, by the way, if anyone wants to see, Google Facebook community standards, and you can walk through and start to see those rules, and we can walk through those.
But to understand here, Scott, this particular post, this picture of the girl in Yemen that was a part of Nicholas Kristof and the New York Times reporting, people are wondering, was this deleted via algorithm or because a person at Facebook, you know, who's seeing all these images real quickly going, this okay, this okay, this okay, that's not okay, delete, this okay, and you got to do it quickly.
There's a bit of opacity as to how Facebook is doing things. You know, they have admitted we're testing AI, we're using AI, but AI, and for folks who don't know, it's artificial intelligence. It is really stunningly bad at a lot of things, and you can't put those baskets in there. So they do have human reviewers. But how a typical process might work is someone sees it and reports it. They flag it and say, hey, I think this violates it, or software or AI may flag it for some reason. And then what we've been told is there is a human reviewer, and that reviewer looks at it. Now, remember, though, think of this in context. Tens of millions of pictures and posts and things are going on all the time. There is somewhere in the neighborhood of 7,500 to 20,000 people reviewing this day in and day out. And they are, I'm sure, extensively tracked. So they probably don't have a lot of time to go through and make a decision. And technically, this post did violate the rules on child nudity. You know, so the person who sees it says, I've got 3 seconds, it violates the rule. I'm going to say, it violates it.
Okay, because of the amount of covered clothing that a 12-year-old was wearing? Is that why it would violate? Jen, yeah?
Yeah, but I believe that's, I mean, you can read into, you know, you can read up on Facebook guidelines. They put them out there. Mm-hmm. And they're broadly defined, but they're broadly defined for a reason, because they now are held to a higher standard of accountability. And so somebody will always err on the side of caution. And we're not talking about journalists. You know, we may be talking about a technology person who, you know, will make a decision. And then if they walk it back, they walk it back.
Okay, fair enough. So let me ask all of you then, given that Nicholas Kristof sort of mounted a bit of a public campaign to pressure Facebook, he got a public response after a day, they admitted it was a mistake. Do we have some sympathy or empathy for Facebook saying, that's a hard job, there's a lot of images that circulate, we do have legitimate concerns about human trafficking, exploitation of children, if they messed this one up, that's one thing, but normally they do pretty well, or, given your various fields, do you think they not do pretty well? William, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm not an expert in this field. I know what I know anecdotally from what I see
fair.
On Facebook
yeah,
and people talking about it, and it seems like the best I could say is that they're inconsistent, because if you read down this thread, there are people that talk about that are posting on Nick's thread that say, well, you know, funny, I posted this and I had it thrown out and I appealed it and they still threw it out after you got your response. And then we'll also turn around and say, yeah, but I've seen other things that I've reported that haven't been kicked off. And this is not the only time I've heard this. I hear this, I read this all the time. It's easy for me to sit here and say, in a very crass way, they're idiots, they don't know what they're doing, and how could they screw this up? Again, millions of photos, I get that, but they've got to figure something out. I think we're all at that point in our lives where if you're going to have something like this and you're going to allow it to happen, you know, all these postings and all of this, and you're going to police it, you've got to figure it out. You're supposed to be the smart ones. You're the ones that are supposed to figure this out, you know, and maybe what it is maybe it's not AI, and maybe what you have to do is you just have to hire more people that you educate better.
You know, but I have to take issue with that.
Sure.
Because from my field, you know, we're looking at documents in litigation or we're doing this, you know, I can hire 10,000 more people and I can train them all exactly the same and they can test perfectly and they can get it. And then they're going to have 11,001 opinions.
Sure.
Because everything is very contextual and the volume is massive.
Well, the volume's massive. So maybe what William's saying is maybe they're overworked. Maybe you need to hire more people, or does Facebook not make any money?
You know, if you have a bad recipe for a cake, hiring 50 more bakers doesn't mean 50 more cakes.
But that's what I'm saying is that they've got to figure out a better recipe. Clearly something isn't working here. I mean, too often in our business, we see things posted on Facebook that are very difficult to look at, that get bounced for quote-unquote community standards, that it seems like, and this is a perfect example to me, that it seems like that they don't teach context at all when they're training their people, or they don't teach it very much to say, okay, here's the image. It pops up under, as Jen described it, under the basic guidelines. But what's the context of it? Is it a news report? Is it something that comes from a legitimate service or a legitimate individual, and go from there? That's where I think, you know, look, we have this in all sorts of oversight, is just bad training. Okay, we could talk about, skills as far as figuring things out in the world, that maybe that's part of it. You know, critical thinking skills just aren't what they should be. I don't know, but to your point.
I think your points are well taken, but I would say, you know, the challenge for Facebook also is that they want a global set of standards. And laugh, and you're right. It's impossible because what we accept in the U.S. is different than Europe, is different than overseas. Like, I think you guys correct me because you're in the business, but Al Jazeera historically had shown a lot more of what was going on overseas than American journalists had shown.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the big challenges. I have some sympathy for Facebook, and I'll just give an example. Let's say I send Evan a message. I post it on Evan's page, and I say, Evan, I'll kill you, right? Well, you know, anybody reasonably would see that and say, Scott and Evan have done a lot of stuff together. He's not really threatening him. But a content moderator who might be in the Philippines or might be AI would be like, wow, that's a pretty classic threat. You know, so the same thing can easily fall both ways.
Okay, Jen?
Yeah, I think that there's two fundamental questions here. And I think one is if it's a technology and training issue, those will get resolved. There'll be a better algorithm. There'll be a secondary step put in place. There'll be another level of training or another level to sort of, you know, to help sort out some of the grayer areas. The question that I have would be, you know, if this is something that's happened repeatedly, I mean, this just happened earlier in October, also with content coming out of Yemen. In this case, it was an image made by Tyler Hicks. It was an extensive report. There was an article written about why some of the images were shown. So that was created proactively by the New York Times. The same situation played out. So prior to FOSTA and SESTA passing in April, 2016, we had a situation where Nikut's 1972 Pulitzer Prize winning image was taken down. So I think the second question, a long way of getting to it, is are they actually putting into place processes that can address issues like this? It keeps coming up. You know, are they proactively doing something about it?
Yeah, and that's where, as a consumer, I don't know, Scott Maloof, I feel like there's one of three things going on here with Facebook. And as the attorney whose work focuses on the intersection of social media and the law, and someone who is more prone to be a shill for Facebook, I'm mostly kidding. I don't think you're a shill.
Whoa!
Wow.
No. Scott, look.
We're going to talk about
Facebook
defamation
mod,
later.
Facebook mods. That was sarcastic, Facebook mods. But I think there's one of three things happening here. I think Facebook created a product at a time when internet usage was exploding, and the kind of product that it turned out humanity wanted. And one of three things is happening. Number one, the product they've created is actually pretty good for all of its flaws. It's a pretty good product. No, I don't think so. Number two, I think it's become sort of a bad product. I think they do a lot of things. I don't think they do it very well. And it's because, you know, they're poorly training people. They're not responding to what the public wants. They're nefarious. They're exploiting us. Or number three, it's gotten so big that inevitably any product like this would have these problems and that we're being too hard on them. Which of the three?
Well, I would add a fourth thing. We're the product, not the customers. You know, we're not paying for it, and so therefore they have to find a way to sell against that. You know, the servers don't pay for themselves. And so, you know, therein is a real tension there because, you know, if I were paying for it every month, they would say, what kind of content do I want? Like, take Netflix, right? We all pay for Netflix if we use it, or Amazon Prime. They know which things we're watching, and they are making production decisions on that. That model doesn't work for Facebook. And I think the other point being, you know, it has gotten so large. It truly is a global community.
Sure.
That it's incredibly hard to manage all of that. You know, as we saw from the New York Times reporting, they had a lot of hand in FOSTA, you know, because of some of the challenges of, you know, protecting their reputation. And now this has sort of come back to become a difficult issue for posters and for them.
Well, for me, here's the thing. I have to admit, I'm on the opposite side of you with this. I feel no sympathy for them whatsoever because, well, the reason
I think your account got suspended just now.
Well, that's fine. I mean, because I think part of the issue here is, first of all, the arrogance of that company that has existed all along and the continued, as Evan said, they don't listen to what people are telling them, you know, and it's always, oh, we're so sorry. Yeah. You know, we're listening to people and we're doing this, and they're doing none of that as far as I can see. They do what they have to do. The whole notion of until people started poking around, well, what's your business model? Oh, well, you know, we do a little this and a little bit of that. And then, you know, come to find out they're data mining every single thing that we do. And oh, yeah, well, you signed away your rights to that. Oh, really? We didn't realize. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for them. And again, part of it is they have a tremendous amount of resources, And I realize that they have a lot of employees. And, you know, it's like everything else in the world in history. When you get sort of greedy and get really massively big, things start to fall apart. And so, you know, at some point, do they have to go away? Do they have to be broken apart? Do they have to have more control over them by the government? I don't know what the answer is. But to me, I've always felt that, or not always, but recently in the last 5 to 10 years, I've felt the internet and then massive people, companies like Google and like Facebook and a few others, they're becoming, you know, the public utilities of the 21st century, and as such, probably should be more regulated than they are, even in this time of deregulation, if that makes any sense.
And I'm not the attorney in the room, but this country gave up on trust busting a long time ago, didn't we?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, you know, ironically, there actually is a state legislator in Arkansas who has proposed a bill to, you know, define, I think it was Facebook, as a public utility. Now, his take was that they're restricting conservative speech. And so this was his way to say, I'm going to get you guys under our aegis. What I'd say is this, as I've said in the past, I think the public utility model is a difficult one because it you know, historically grew up. There was the power plant. It was local. We paid for it,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Versus this thing we don't. But what you've said is very clear. People are seeing the externalities and they're not happy. The best example being Airbnb, where you see people who live in a building who say, somebody owns that apartment or that condo. They don't live there. I see 50 new people every month because they're renting it. And there has been a lot of pushback, and I understand that. And and back to what Jen had said when she talked about the publication of the Facebook rules, that came out because they historically have not been transparent.
Yeah.
Your post got bounced. It violated community standards. Which ones? Why? What aspect of it? You never heard.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to do that. But you're right. They're fighting behind the eight ball because of so many things.
Jen?
William talks about the tremendous resources. And the number one resource, you know, that they have are users, are the eyeballs. And you know, for that reason, journalistic platforms need to be there. You know, that is, like it or not, that is where a huge amount of the readership is coming from and coming through. And it may be an article at a time shared on, you know, the news feed of friends, but that is a value to news services. And so, you know, I think that there is a relationship there. The, you know, Facebook and others want content. So there's, you know, there is a little bit of deal making going on in terms of needing each other. And as part of that, I think what stuff like this underscores, incidents like this underscore, is that we do have to be vigilant. You know, I don't believe that Facebook will, or any other platform or any other entity, will move to action without voices coming from the public. You know, in the case of the Nikut picture, you know, it took the Norwegian prime minister to really become involved and to actively call for members of that country's public to be posting and talking about this before there was a response from Facebook. And it came directly from Sheryl Sandberg. But, you know, the vigilance of when we see something like this, speaking up about it, I think is a key, you know, a key factor in trying to mitigate the problem in the future.
Jen, I think the photo you're referencing is the one from the Vietnam War about the 9-year-old girl running away from the
Nepal. Yeah, Kim Phuc. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Just so folks know.
Just to be clear, because I just got an email about that. Linda writing the program saying, was there not a case like this a few years ago with a classic photo of the girl running?
Yes, right. That's it. 2016.
And it was temporarily taken down because the girl was nude, and therefore it was identified as child pornography by Facebook.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. So how did that resolve? It was
So it was playing out in Norway, and the Norwegian prime minister got involved. There's, you know, extensive writing about this. And then after a call, you know, sort of challenging, you know, this is an historic picture. This is a Pulitzer Prize winning picture that talks about important historic, you know, important parts of history. You know, there was a public outcry, and Sheryl Sandberg did respond. And, you know, she did, I think I have her quote in my notes here, but she did respond. She did say they don't get it right always, and she did welcome, you know, people and thank people for being involved. You know, the idea here is that the public outcry had to be there in order to spur this.
But I think that supports William's earlier point, which was, we're really sorry, we're going to fix this, but for the 10,000 photos going forward that didn't have the Prime Minister of Norway calling.
Right.
Well, and I want to back this up just a little bit. Evan, you kind of indicated when you reached out to us about the bigger issue of these kinds of photos, period.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things to consider is, would Nick's picture run on the front page of the New York Times and hundreds of other newspapers across the country now? Would Eddie Adams' picture of the street execution run on the front pages of papers now? You know,
what's the answer?
You know, I don't know anymore. I know that there are some of us that would push for it and want to push for it. But, you know, there are things that have, quote unquote, changed. There are people, their sensitivities have changed. And so I think that kind of plays into what we're talking about as far as community standards are concerned. What's acceptable? You know, AP, in the guise of Jen and my friend Hal Buell, during the Vietnam War and that era in general, ran some amazingly, amazingly tough images to show the world what was going on. I don't know that there's that much will to do that anymore because of corporate sensibilities and the sort of, you know, I used to work at a newspaper that was fairly conservative, and we had a hard time getting very difficult pictures that were deemed local. And we used to call it the Three Rivers Rule. If it happened within Three Rivers of where we were, it probably wouldn't happen. Because they quite simply did not want to field the complaints, no matter how large or how small they were. And yet, when it came time for economic considerations and said, you know, we can no longer support three pages of comics, we're going to cut a page worth, they got literally thousands of complaints. But did they change their minds? Absolutely not. So, you know, where are the corporate sensibilities for all of this? As more and more corporate ownership of media consolidates and consolidates and consolidates, no one that has anything to do with our business owns these things, and they just don't want to deal with any of the backlash. So I think part of that plays into some of these community standards. I think part of that plays into what Facebook does. You know, for me, that's part of the issue is, okay, Nick Ut's picture of this, of Kim Fook, you know, it's a very difficult picture to look at. I could see, you know, posting that on Facebook and literally thousands of people complaining about it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Facebook does take it down. Is that the right thing to do, too?
Right. And picking up on that, you know, we can't just look at organizations like Facebook or corporations. We have to say as users,
yeah,
we have to accept that there are going to be things that we're uncomfortable hearing or seeing. That's, you know, if you ask me about the First Amendment, people love to say First Amendment, these are my rights, until they hear and see stuff that they don't like.
Yeah.
And then they say, that's not fair. And it's, you're going to be offended. It's terrible. It stinks. When I talk to clients and stuff happens, I have tons of empathy for them. But we as a society, and America has really gotten this right, have said, we are going to protect speech, we're going to protect it. And everyone who's a listener right now, think about all the images you've seen in history, you know, whether it's a school book or at art or just stuff you've come across, and how memorable that is compared to maybe a thought or an argument that you've read. And that's what the power of these things, and we have
the
to recognize
that. The power of the images.
That. Yeah,
right.
It's absolutely true.
And on that note, by the way, I can't believe Jen and William haven't gotten on my back about the fact that there is a photojournalist with a name who took this picture, and I think it's Giles Clark in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So credit where it's due there. Nicholas Kristof raised the fuss, and understandably, he's got a pretty big microphone through the work he does with the New York Times. Giles Clark, the photographer who took the image of the girl named Abrar, a 12-year-old girl in Yemen, a victim of famine as a result of the war. She is starving. Doctors don't know if she will survive. She weighs 28 pounds, and her image, I think, is one that is moving a lot of people, especially now that some of the media gatekeepers have allowed it to be run again. So that's one of the reasons we're here. I'm way late for a break. Bob in Honeyway Falls, I'll take your call when we come back. And I've got a pile of email and thoughts from listeners on how Facebook is handling this, uncomfortable images, and how they might move us to action or understanding about the world around us, and whether you're quitting Facebook in 2019. Let's come right back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it has been a very swingy 10 days on Wall Street. The market's way down, then up, and then way down again. It feels like it did 10 years ago. And we're reviewing the year in finance and economic development. Unemployment numbers are low. Should we trust them? What about other fundamentals? We're going to talk about how policy impacts locally and nationally and more next hour. Welcome back to Connections. A lot of different threads tying together this hour. The power of photojournalism, media gatekeepers like Facebook, and the story of a photograph of a young girl in Yemen who is starving, perhaps starving to death as a result of this war and famine, and Facebook's initial decision to delete and ban the photo on the grounds that it was obscene. And we're talking about that with William Snyder, who is chair of the photojournalism program at RIT, and Jen Poggi, assistant professor of photojournalism there, Scott Maloof, an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. And we'll get back to the photo in a second and related issues. Bob in Honeyway Falls has a separate concern with Facebook. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I completely agree that if you're not paying for something, then you are the product. However, what we found, my wife and I, is we'll talk about a product that we've never researched, we've never Googled, and an hour or two later, an advertisement for that product will show up on her Facebook feed. So I think that's a little too far-reaching, and I'm actually curious how they do it.
So, Bob, thank you for the phone call. Just on that note, again, this is sort of tangential, but it's related to Facebook. Damon Linker is a columnist for The Week who tweeted just last night. He wrote the following: "Today, my wife and I had a private conversation about a medical problem. An hour later, she saw an ad on Facebook about that problem. This blank is so much more blank than we realize," is what Damon's conclusion as a paid columnist was. Now, I've been told by people who have studied this, and there's a couple of great podcasts that my colleague Veronica Volk directs me to that will sort of elucidate a little bit more here. One of them is from the podcast Reply All. Their episode number 109 is Facebook spying on you? And by the way, Veronica told me the answer was no. They're not exactly in the way that Damon Linker or Bob and Honeyway Falls think. It's actually worse. She said, listen to the episode. I said, oh, good. Also, Radiolab did a piece on Facebook called Post No Evil. So, Scott Maloof, do we know if Facebook is spying on us? And by the way, they can hear you.
You know, I think the real challenge, let's take the post you just had about listening. I think the real issue there is if you have an Alexa or you have, you know, one of the Google Home devices, those devices are going to always be on, and they're going to be listening for that wake-up word, hey, Alexa. You know, now, I think we get to the next stage of that issue, which is what is happening with that data? How are they hearing it? Because, you know, you may have a friend named Alex and you may have an Alexa. And so it needs to differentiate between Alex and Alexa. And that is data is being analyzed. The next question becomes, and this goes back to William's complaint, we don't know how the rest of that data, Alex versus Alexa and everything surrounding it, is being analyzed. What are they listening for? Can I definitively sit here and say, you know, Facebook or whoever's using that is preparing that for advertising? No, because I don't know. We don't have that transparency. I would assume not, because of the fact that they would say this is a massive violation of our users' trust. You know, but, you know, I don't know how the particular aspects of his thing came up. He may say, we never searched it, we never did it, and then a week later he says, oh, yeah, my wife did search that.
Yeah, my observation watching Mark Zuckerberg and other you know, the head of Google and others who have testified in front of Congress is, number one, we need elected leaders who understand technology a little bit better than members of Congress do. They can barely figure out how to turn on their phone, and their questions were really, really sort of embarrassing. But also, when they did ask good questions on those rare occasions, I thought Zuckerberg and his ilk are pretty good at saying nothing, saying a lot of words while saying nothing.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, the real issue is the technology, the easier it is to use, the more complicated it genuinely is. You know, something that listens to you 24/7, you know, is going to have a ton of data, but they are going to say, we don't. So let's take Alexa. You know, Amazon has had requests from police officers, from law enforcement, to give them recordings, and they have generally opposed that. You know, so from their perspective, you know, it's not, oh, we want every single bit of data on you. There can be problems. So what I'd say is, I don't have a definitive answer to that, and it's not clear. And as we go forward, what Jen has said, you have to continue to push and push, yeah, and we'll get more clarity. I just want to make a quick mention of one thing. You know, I'm also concerned about people who aren't recognized journalists. You know, the Philando Castile, you know, mm-hmm, the aftermath of his shooting was broadcast on Facebook.
Facebook Live, right?
Right, Facebook Live. And then it came down and then went back up. And so we have to recognize that, you know, we now have tons of people who are recording things that we would not have seen, and that is having a big impact. So we can't just treat it. I know Nicholas Kristof, you know, tweeted at, I think, at Facebook and said, well, shouldn't our content and, you know, New York Times content and Wall Street Journal content automatically get a pass? And it's funny. The more I thought about that, it just sticks in my craw, because you have, you know, journalists who are doing tens of thousands of things that are really important, and they're not with those organizations. And those people need a system that works for them as well.
Yeah, but what I would say about that is sort of my whole – I realize there are great things that are happening out there that people are capturing and putting out, and I think that's great. This whole notion of citizen journalists is something that sticks in my craw.
So we've got craws stuck on both sides.
Because here's the thing. You know, do you like citizen lawyers?
Do I?
Yes.
You know, it's funny. Like, that's a really good topic because, you know, by the way, PSA for folks – Twitter is not a good place to get your legal advice. Just don't.
Yes. Well, but this is my point is I think that professionally trained journalism organizations should get a pass because, for the most part, although again this comes with corporate, you know, consolidation, sure, and downsizing, There is a vetting process that goes on here. There is an editing process that filters all of this stuff. And these are supposedly professionally trained individuals. And so because of that, I think Nick is absolutely right, is that when it comes to social media, they should get a pass. I do understand what you mean about individuals on the street getting, but here's the thing. Everybody's talked about citizen journalism and what a great thing it was during the Arab Spring, because it was kind of raw and new, and everybody was just posting things and we're getting really good stuff. Well, by the time the next uprising happened, there were some very sophisticated individuals that were using those raw feeds in a very pointed way, a very one-sided way, a very, propagandist way. Yeah. So that's the issue that we always have to deal with. Again, and that's why I use the legal thing. I'd like to think I'm a really smart guy. I'm married to an attorney, and I know as much as anybody else, but I really don't. And it's like being a journalist.
Jen? That was a loaded sigh from Jen.
Yeah,
Burgess.
you were wondering
if you were going to come in and adjudicate this whole matter.
Yeah.
What I want to say is that there is a great democratization with the information available online, and so we do know that there is greater access if you have a legal question, if you have a medical question. Sure, that doesn't make you a lawyer, but it does make a lot of information accessible to you. And I think it's what's interesting is that it relates to, the topic at hand, because never before have we as citizens had greater access to information, and yet the irony is that we also have a greater ability to turn away from it.
Yeah.
And I think to the caller's point earlier, I cannot tell you how articles or advertisements show up. I've had that happen as well. I have questions around it, but I think the general attitude, Pew Research and others have done lots of polling and sort of analytics about public perception and feelings about privacy issues and whether we're being monitored and to what degree. The reality is that people complain about it, and yet they're not willing to give up the conveniences that technology offer. And so it's quite a slippery slope.
I think that's a great point.
And just picking up on what William and Jen said.
Keep it tight, by the way.
Real quick.
I've got a pile of listener comments.
Real quick. And that's such a good point about intermediaries and having quality, because social has way too many posts. And you're right. I'd rather see the journalist who's been in the Middle East for 10 years who says, here's what's actually happening. So it's a good point.
Yeah.
Bob in Brighton wants to know, historically, are we at a point where government regulation of social media platforms is worth investigating?
We're going to see that coming down. More and more people are interested in, as Jen said, privacy.
Okay. I mean, so it's almost inevitable it's going to happen.
California has already passed its own privacy law. It is a huge, huge, complicated mess. Europe has GDPR, which is more understandable, but most likely we're going to see more.
Well, and the great thing about what Europe has done is it's automatically affecting what's happening here.
Yep.
Which is, sort of de facto already being done, which I'm okay with. I have privacy concerns, but I also have this thing about, well, do we want the government that deeply into what we're doing? I don't know. It's a conundrum.
Okay. I'm going to get some more emails that have come in here. And this one from Andrew comes with a photograph attached that I had not seen. He says, Evan, I do not do Facebook. Disturbing photos involving children are not new. Attached, I have sent a photo published by National Geographic a few years ago of a starving Sudanese child being stalked by a vulture. The photographer in the magazine took flack for the photo. I think the photographer took the child to get some medical attention. And yes, the photo is very disturbing, but it is real. Setting politics aside, the photo shows what some people on this planet have to go through. Well, many people do not read magazines anymore. Many people don't even pay attention to regular television and or radio, even gasp NPR. So Andrew is saying these photographs do show the world. And the photograph he's referencing, I had not seen. It is a difficult image to look at. It's exactly what he described. Both of you familiar. Scott, were you familiar?
Yeah. I hadn't seen it. I was not familiar.
Okay.
With it.
So Jen, you're nodding right away here. In this case, this is a starving child laying in sort of a hayfield field. There's a vulture in there. I mean, it's just a horrible image. And Andrew's saying, we must be able to find a way to consume this kind of content if we want to understand the world. What would you add to that?
I wouldn't add anything. I think that's absolutely the case. Mm-hmm. I think the importance is that, you know, the work needs to be done. It doesn't do any good to the public to sanitize what's happening. These are difficult images, and the conversations need to happen in the newsroom to understand, okay, in each case, you know, you cannot create sort of a global set of rules that apply universally to every image or into any kind of circumstance. But I think that there are professional ethics, you know, there are organizations that you know, sort of watch vigilantly and make sure that education is there for the journalists making the imagery. And the conversations that happen in the newsroom about whether to publish have to happen, and you have to have a very clear understanding of why you're making those decisions. Is it gratuitous? Is it, you know, is it considered too horrific? You know, why do we need to publish this image at this time in this place? And I think the transparency that we're seeing more proactively happening is that along with those, the publishing of those kinds of imagery, news organizations are saying proactively, here's how we made this decision and why we made it.
And just picking up on what Jen said real quick, that's the challenge of the intermediary economy, the Facebook being in the room with you. And that's why a lot of organizations are saying, we want an app where we can take that out. But then, of course, the app still has to go through Google or Apple.
Well, one thing I just wanted to add in there, you know, this gets back to my feeling of arrogance about Facebook and Google and all that. These are issues that they're dealing with. To my knowledge, and I could be absolutely wrong, have they hired any former journalists that have been put out of business because of corporate
really
consolidation
to
guide them on these things and to train people?
Well, if you look at the Facebook standards, you can see it's clearly been vetted. And that podcast that Evan mentioned, you know, Post No Evil from Radiolab, talks about years of working on breastfeeding images. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if, you know, somebody woke up overnight. Who they've hired to do it, you know, we'd have to look in.
But that's a great point. Let me read another email from a listener as we get ready to wrap this, this frenetic hour of discussion here and so many comments. Katarina says, Evan, I heard a program on NPR not too long ago that featured interviews with people hired to screen the content on YouTube. I'm not sure if you remember or heard this, but it was very unnerving. She says, I felt horrible for this employee being interviewed. You have no idea what they've witnessed, and to imagine there are many people who are doing this and viewing images and video of the most horrendous acts, as well as some hilarious cat videos, I'm sure. She says, the suggestion of adding more staff to view these posts sickens me. Who will have these jobs? Maybe the lower echelon of society, low income, low skill, already disadvantaged. Maybe not, but regardless, they're human, and now they have their heads filled with disgusting imagery. That's from Katarina. I take the point that it can be tough, but I don't agree that no one should be subjected to it. I mean, it's a job. This is part of...
Then you're in a position of then no moderation can happen.
Yeah.
You know, the organizations have looked at it. I know they're having counseling with folks. But the challenge, like many things, is if they're outsourcing it to a third-party company, how responsible is that third party
exactly.
to these
well,
folks?
And it's the training and that goes along with it. You know, this whole notion of being, well, you know, it's lower class work and things like that. Well, This is highly critical, sensitive things when you talk about society as a general, and should not be reserved for the lowest echelon of pay and education and understanding. It just shouldn't.
Yeah, and I would just, you know, sort of add to that. I mean, I think I'm not someone who's – I'm very squeamish about blood, about gore. I can't see a needle stuck in an arm like by a doctor. I have a hard time with that. Other people, no problem with that. So people have different sort of constitutions anyway, and I understand that this work can be hard, but I don't think that's an argument against hiring more people to do it.
No, you know, it is interesting, and I hate to bring this up at like the last minute. Maybe this is another, but there was an interesting situation with law enforcement in Ohio about 2 years ago when a police department decided to post an image to Facebook, to release this image on Facebook after an opioid overdose. It was two adults in a car with a child. Mm. Nobody was hurt.
Yep.
You know, but they talked about using the platform to post the picture as a means of sort of public awareness of the opioid epidemic, particularly in their community. And it became an international debate with sort of various layers to that debate. So it's a tool. It was tough to look at. Organizations handled that image differently in terms of how they reproduced it to report on the article. But I think to William's point, there's a lot of training that goes into understanding ethics, certainly understanding legality, of publishing images. It's a highly trained field, and to sort of relegate that to an untrained eye would increase the trauma of seeing the content, but also increase the opportunity for poor decisions to be made.
All right, so I'm going to violate my own standards and give you a yes-no question as we close the hour. Casey Hunt from NBC News, in her post describing why she's quitting Facebook, says this: to anyone who uses Facebook as a place to get news, I urge you, don't at all. It's bad for your brain, divides you from your neighbors, and it's worse for democracy. Read the paper, watch the news, or read websites where people are paid to not make mistakes and hold themselves to a publisher's higher standard, end quote. Yes or no? You don't get to elaborate. Agree or disagree? William?
I'm going to say no.
Okay. Jen?
Wait, no to what?
I don't agree with her.
It's like diet, everything in moderation.
Okay. Okay, Scott?
Use the highest quality resource you can, even
absolutely,
if you have to pay for it.
And multiple sources.
Yes. Correct. Get a subscription to your newspaper and have a membership at your local public radio.
Most of my friends are journalists, so most of what I see is really high quality journalism.
William
on my
Snyder
Facebook
and Jen Poggi, photojournalists, and they're coming to us from RIT. Thank you for your time. And Scott Maloof, an attorney, thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you.
More connections coming up.